This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, it's been over 8 months since Hurricane Maria devastated most of the island of Puerto Rico, a territory that's still grappling with lack of electricity and infrastructure.
Well, Mark, a report just conducted by the Harvard School of Public Health has concluded that the storm's after effects have led to far more deaths than previously thought. The official government death toll still stands at 64, but the Harvard researchers discovered some 4,600 deaths can be attributed to the storm.
What a tragedy. And the researchers looked at mortality data during the months after the storm and found that many who no longer had access to medical care or vital medications succumbed to preventable causes. And there's been a dramatic rise of depression and isolation among those who are still stranded without electricity or infrastructure. That's led to an increase in the number of suicides, which has risen dramatically in Puerto Rico in recent months.
The researchers in the Harvard study were compelled to provide this data so that it might inform the response to major disasters in the future. We just need to do better.
And as we know, population health is always improved with good actionable data. And that brings us to our guest today. Dr. Eric Tobol is a renowned cardiologist and champion of advancing the promise of genomics. Dr. Tobol is now lending his expertise to the All of Us Precision Medicine Initiative at NIH. Really looking forward to that conversation, Margaret.
And today, Laurie Robertson will stop by, the managing editor of factcheck.org. No matter what the topic, though, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. Also, don't forget to leave us a review and subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Eric Tobol in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. After many attempts, Virginia is the latest state in the nation to expand Medicaid for a broader swath of its population. For years, Democratic Governor Terry McAuliffe had tried to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, but was blocked by the Republican legislature. Now, Virginia Governor Ralph Northam is in the seat, and four Republicans have reached across the aisle, joining Democrats in the legislature to make approval a reality. Virginia, the 33rd state in the nation to expand Medicaid to provide health coverage to more of its low-income residents. The healthcare industry is weighing in on President Trump's new rules governing the health insurance industry, and 95% of more than 300 health industry organizations and patient advocacy groups who commented on the proposals registered deep concern or overt opposition to the proposals, which eliminate many of the protections for people with pre-existing conditions, not covering things like pregnancy and other women's health issues, and not covering essential things like medications. State insurance regulators from both sides of the aisle have registered grave concerns about how the proposals will destabilize the markets and lead to chaos among insurance customers. The American Cancer Society has changed its recommendations for screening for colorectal cancers, saying baseline colonoscopies should begin now at age 45, not 50, as was the previous protocol. The new ruling comes in the wake of increased cases of colorectal cancer among younger adults. The new recommendations also urge regular screenings up to age 75. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Eric Tobol, founder and director of the Scripps Translational Science Institute and executive vice president and professor of molecular medicine at the Scripps Research Institute at La Jolla, California. Prior to that, he served as chairman of cardiovascular medicine at Cleveland Clinic, where he founded the Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine. Dr. Tobol has published over 1,100 articles and papers, as well as several books, including The Creative Destruction of Medicine and The Patient Will See You Now. He was named by Modern Healthcare as the most influential physician leader in the country. He earned his medical degree from the University of Rochester and completed his cardiology residency at Johns Hopkins. Dr. Tobol, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks very much, Mark. Good to be with you.
Yeah, you know, we had you back in 2012, and it was a conversation we had about hope for opportunity to leverage genomics and digital health. Now here we are in 2018, and you say that we're at a turning point of medicine, pointing to the All of Us Precision Medicine Initiative recently launched by NIH. And I want to give out a shout out to Dr. Francis Collins. We were one of the 10 health systems selected in that initial cohort. And I wonder if you could share with our listeners why this initiative is such a transformational moment in healthcare.
Well, I think the biggest difference is that prior to recent times, we couldn't really understand the uniqueness of each person. We now have the tools to do that. And these are sensors and the genome and other biological layers of information like the gut microbiome. So up until recent times, we really practiced medicine in the dark. And now with All of Us that you mentioned and the tools that we have before us, it's a very exciting time to change medicine to be far more individualized and precise with better outcomes, prevention being, you know, being much more potentiated by these tools in the future.
Well, Dr. Topol, it's certainly a key goal of the All of Us initiative is to coalesce vast amounts of data from the million participants, everything from their genomic data to behavioral and biological data, all to be collected and synthesized and shared. So I understand your organization, Scripps, was awarded a grant to develop something called a Participant Technology Center that would facilitate the collection and storage of data from these million participants. Tell us more about what you're creating at Scripps to support the All of Us initiative, and what's your guiding vision for gathering this massive amount of data?
It's called the Participant Center, which is all the participant-facing technologies like their apps, the website, data going back to them that they generate through their sensors or through their DNA. And also we're responsible for enrolling hundreds of thousands of participants through whether it's Walgreens clinics or whether it's blood bank centers. So we have a lot of responsibility at this Participant Center, but it's to keep the engagement throughout decades ahead for each of the million and likely much more than a million people that they want to be active throughout their journey in the All of Us program. So that isn't just about getting data back, but also, you know, whether that's education, whether that's them making things fun, manage competitions. You know, we're going to be getting a lot of the folks who wanted various sensors. Like, we already started a pilot with blood pressure watches. We're also doing a pilot of getting all the data for each person aggregated throughout their many years of their lives. So we're doing a lot of things that are not necessarily for all million people, but trying to find out what is really promoting engagement along with data collection. So it's a pluripotent type of role or effort that we have, and we're really thrilled to be doing it.
Well, I love the word making it fun and engagement, right. None of which could be ascribed to patient portals.
Right.
You know? And, you know, a lot of this is going to be done on smartphones, and they're going to play such an important role in the All of Us program. You've sort of talked about the smartphone as a Gutenberg moment in medicine. But there's been a lot of technologies that have been leveraged with the smartphone, like the FDA-approved EKG app you helped develop, or advances in gene editing. And you recently published the top 10 tech advances shaping medicine. I wonder if you could share with our listeners some of the technologies that we should be keeping an eye on.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that's really kicking in now is the era of artificial intelligence in medicine. At the end of November last year, the first smart watch electrocardiogram diagnosis of atrial fibrillation was approved by the FDA.
Right.
And that combines a live core with the Apple Watch. If you're wearing the watch, it senses for you what is your normal resting heart rate, what is your activity heart rate, and then if something is really out of kilter, it will give you a signal that you should take your cardiogram, which entails putting your thumb on the watch band. Mm. And then you're told whether or not you have an abnormal heart rhythm. So for people who, for example, they've had a fainting spell or have a known heart rhythm problem, this is a really nice tool that's now the first consumer FDA-approved artificial intelligence algorithm. There'll be many more, but the point being is that there's a promotion of more autonomy for each individual should they be interested in using these apps. We want to see them become widely available and inexpensive. Right now, we have seen a big jump in diabetes technology, mm-hmm. where no longer the new sensors, you don't have to calibrate them with finger sticks. Mm-hmm. They're factory calibrated. They're easy to put on, and they get very accurate continuous glucose measurements, but they're still, you know, relatively expensive. And the algorithms that support them are not very smart. In the future, we're going to have algorithms that factoring in your physical activity, sleep, nutrition, you know, all these really relevant covariates that affect your glucose management. So we're right in the midst of new exciting technologies, but still a ways to go where, you know, we know where we need to be.
I couldn't resist just taking a moment to imagine what the arc of your career in cardiology must seem like when you think back to your earliest days of residency or fellowship training and watching the little spool of EKG paper come off of the machine to what
yeah,
you have.
Yeah, well, it was also the whole idea today. That when we had heart attack patients, we had nothing to offer them
exactly.
except oxygen and morphine. It's come
amazing.
A long way, and it's been an area of great progress,
yep.
but there's still heart disease along with cancer are yep. you know, very major sources of death and morbidity, and we can't feel
right.
complacent.
Still working on prevention. But, you know, another person who we've come to know through interviews on the show, Dr. David Blumenthal, who we just had on the show again recently from the Commonwealth Fund, and he was talking about his efforts during the rollout of the HITECH Act, which, of course, led to faster, wider adoption of electronic health records, but we haven't seen such great interoperability, and in particular, the ability maybe to tap into the flow of health information between patients and providers. I guess we now have to think of it in two ways, both the information that's going from patients to providers, but also the information that's going from patients' wearables and devices to providers who are not sitting at a desk somewhere waiting to receive it necessarily.
Well, first, you've mentioned a couple of people that I really think so highly of, Francis Collins and now just David Blumenthal. As far as the data flow, the thing that I'm most passionate about is that everyone needs to own their data. That's the only way we can achieve the coalescence of sensor, the traditional medical record, genomic data, you know, all these different sources, much of which don't go into the electronic record that sits in certain health systems, but it's hard to get at. So I am pushing for where each person has all their data on a secure platform, whether it be a private cloud or a blockchain or some type of hybrid of those. And then they can share it, whether they go see a doctor or they want to be part of a research program. But they are controlling it rather than sitting on massive servers, which are a magnet for cyber thievery and hackers. Medical data is the most valuable form of data in the world today. Fivefold more valuable than your financial and personal data huh. on the dark web.
Wow.
So we have got to fix this. No one has, in this country, has all their medical data. It should be prenatal all the way through their life, because even if they're in a health system they never move from, they can't get to all the data
right.
from earlier. Plus, they don't have their sensor data, you know, their genomic data all in one place, suitable for artificial intelligence or deep learning for that person, coaching that person in the years ahead. It won't necessarily be through a smartphone, but rather through smart speakers, voice assistants that will be medicalized. So you'll be using voice and you'll be getting prompts, whether it's through text or voice, about, you know, your data. But you have to have all the data in to have good outputs. And right now we're not set up for that.
We're speaking today with Dr. Eric Topol, founder and director of the Scripps Translational Science Institute and executive vice president and professor of molecular medicine at the Scripps Research Institute. Boy, you've touched on a lot of great things. We've got to liberate data, but people have to own the data. And then the whole voice activation opportunities that present themselves. But I worry about the hackers and the ability to grab information and sort of the lack of security. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about potential solutions are out there. I think HIPAA, Margaret, maybe mm-hmm. 1996, it was first passed. I'm wondering who's laying out some of the technological mm-hmm. standards as well as the legal standards as well.
Well, I think your point about HIPAA being over 20 years old, and it's a relic now relative to what's changed in the digital world. Other countries are way ahead. The U.S. is in a kind of standstill mode. There's no question we want to protect privacy, but, you know, the whole landscape has changed. So something has to be done, but as far as I know, there's no move afoot to have a new legislation that's vital. Right now, our medical data is being sold, it's being brokered, it's being stolen and hacked all over the place. And nothing's being done to protect it. So I'm quite worried about that, and I'd like to see both legislative as well as a technological solution. I've outlined the tech solution, but the one in terms of a new privacy, security, medical data bill is desperately needed, and hopefully we'll see it someday, but I'm not aware of any work that's being done actively yet.
And right on those topics is the cost of healthcare, American healthcare, now in terms of rapid and escalating healthcare costs. We're thinking maybe further disruption may come from the outside entities. What do you see as the greatest potential for reining in costs?
You know, one, which is ridiculous that it doesn't happen, is that the government should be negotiating prices, and they're not. Whether that's drugs and devices, we suffer. But as far as things that could be done, you know, the hospitals account for one-third of the $3.5 trillion expenditures. If you could get a lot of people out of the hospital in their own home getting sensors and artificial intelligence monitoring, which can be exquisite and be as good as an intensive care unit monitoring, but nothing's being done to get the hospitals gutted in this country, which the regular rooms could be basically be largely replaced by home monitoring. The reason, of course, is the fixation on current reimbursement paths that don't exist for home monitoring. So we have these, you know, perverse incentives to keep the system as it is. Another big on the list is all the inappropriate, unnecessary things that are done, whether they're scans or lab tests, in a promiscuous way, and they've been published, choosing wisely and right care. All these things have been published, but nothing is being done to actually make it day-to-day medical practice. So, you know, we're talking about things that could reduce our healthcare bill from $3.5 trillion to potentially close to $2 trillion or less just by taking action, but there is no action.
I was thinking about, you've been focusing on how to redesign and redefine the clinical settings, and I could set aside the reimbursement system, but we know from our own clinicians, one more click and I'll jump off the bridge here. You were talking earlier about maybe voice activation. How do we get the patient and the provider looking at each other? So we have to sort of think about that. And then just a sort of leveraging of artificial intelligence. You've been talking about in this whole context of telling people they own the data and they also have responsibilities on that. What's that vision look like of that new clinical setting?
Well, it'll be revamped. There will be no keyboards because natural language processing, just the natural voice of both the patient and doctor, can be made into a beautiful note and can be done. All the coding can be done from it. It's already been demonstrated. And not only that, but you'd have the patient edit the note because the patient's notes are often mistakes and they never get a chance to look at it. And then you have machine learning for the doctor so that they don't have to spend a lot of time reviewing it for that particular doctor or clinician. So we're headed to a keyboard-free zone someday. There's many startups and some of the leading tech titans like Microsoft are working on this. So it's just a matter of time. But the clinical setting, it's going to give much more efficiency, productivity for every clinician. It's going to give much more autonomy for patients. But all this takes time. It takes evidence. I'm very encouraged that over time, and this could be the way medicine moves, it could be a long time, but that over time we'll see a rebooting of the clinical landscape.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Eric Topol, founder and director of the Scripps Translational Science Institute and executive vice president and professor of molecular medicine at the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla, California. You can learn more about his work by going to stsiweb.org and follow him on Twitter at Eric Topol. Dr. Topol, thank you so much for your groundbreaking work, your enormous contributions to health and healthcare, and thanks for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
President Donald Trump made two misleading claims during a campaign rally in Nashville. He said the individual mandate provision of the Affordable Care Act was, quote, so unconstitutional. In fact, the Supreme Court ruled the individual mandate was constitutional. In a 5-4 opinion on June 28, 2012, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote that the penalty, as it was described in the Affordable Care Act, is actually a tax collected by the IRS, and it is within congressional powers to impose new taxes. Trump can have the opinion that it should have been ruled unconstitutional, but it was not. The president made the claim in discussing the recent tax law, which eliminated the individual mandate tax in 2019. The president also said the Senate's failure in 2017 to pass a bill that would have repealed and replaced the Affordable Care Act, quote, cost our country $1 trillion in entitlement savings. Congressional budget experts say it would have saved a net total of $321 billion over 10 years, not $1 trillion. In addition to reducing health care spending, mostly on Medicaid, the Senate health care bill would have repealed or modified tax provisions in the ACA that provide increased revenues to the federal treasury. So while the legislation would have lowered spending by $1 trillion over 10 years, it also would have lowered revenues by $701 billion over 10 years. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Students of public health are often tasked with devising interventions for addressing some of health's biggest challenges. And for Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health students Dan Wexler and Priya Patel, their idea netted an award and launched a business idea at the same time, tasked with addressing food insecurity in underserved parts of the world, including in neighborhoods in their own backyard. Families finding fresh, affordable, healthy food in neighborhoods with no grocery stores or food markets. They thought of the current trend of healthy mail order meals services like Blue Apron and wondered, what if we modified that business model to serve the needs of those living in food deserts? Wexler and his partner sourced food delivery companies that could provide prepackaged meal kits with all ingredients included. And instead of home delivery approach, they designed refrigerated kiosks that could easily be placed in local neighborhoods.
I think the biggest change is that there is no delivery system door-to-door per se, and that by setting up these kiosks in the community, you can have a very lean design. You don't need a storefront. You don't need to have in-box refrigeration, and you are very much addressing the need of access by physically saying, hey, here is healthy food. It's convenient because everything you need is in the box. And so just really thinking about how can we take all those lean designs that really make it a solution that has the potential for impact.
And they also conducted research with local ethnic groups to create recipes that would resonate with their families.
And we just went down to the community and did taste testing, talked to people and said, you know, what do you want to be able to eat for dinner? How do you want to cook? Basically, we have some dishes that are similar textures, similar spices. One thing that we found is there's a little bit of contention between parents who want to eat more traditional foods and kids who want to eat more American foods. And we tried to bridge those gaps. So one of our recipes, for instance, is a chicken pot pie pasta. So it's fun sounding, but also we use a lot of traditional seasonings and spices.
Customers can simply walk to the kiosk and purchase their meal kits with the SNAP cards or cash. And they added benefits. The kiosk will be run by the residents of the neighborhood, giving them an opportunity to purchase the kiosk and run them like a franchise. offering an economic benefit to the community as well. Their idea earned them the Rabobank MIT Food and Agribusiness Innovation Prize and $15,000 in startup money to launch their enterprise, a low-cost, portable, healthy meal service placed in portable kiosk in food desert neighborhoods, offering families a simple solution to address the problem of poor nutrition, providing an economic opportunity at the same time. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.